standard GMT. However, there are reports of Israeli tanks shelling eastern Khan Yunis and Rafah. The Israeli army has also used live fire and tear gas to stop Palestinians in southern Gaza from returning to their homes in the north, leaving two people dead. As part of the ceasefire arrangement, the first group of Israeli captives made up of 13 people are set to be released later in the day. 39 Palestinian prisoners will also be released. According to Hamas, a total of 238 trucks are expected to enter Gaza on Friday. Several are already there. Brief hiatus in the war follows 48 days of relentless Israeli airstrikes that have killed over 15,000 Palestinians and displaced countless others. The Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement says that Israeli regime has failed to achieve its stated goals in the Gaza war. In a televised address, Ziad al-Nakhala added the current prisoner swap deal with Tel Aviv will ultimately lead to another agreement that will force the regime into releasing all Palestinian prisoners. He said the resistance front will continue fighting and prevent enemy from reaching its objectives. Nakhala added the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa Flood has caused an earthquake within the Israeli regime and shed light on Western support for Tel Aviv. He also thanked resistance groups in Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen for courageously supporting the Palestinian people. Nakhala underlined that those who speak of governing Gaza should think of protecting their own people instead. The Palestinians in the city of Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, welcome the truce taking effect in the besieged enclave. And let's take a listen to some comments by the residents there.
It is true that everyone is very happy that there is a truce and a ceasefire. But the issue is that we, the residents of the north, were uprooted because of the bombardment, and we won't be able to go back to our homes. This is tragic. We want to go to see our homes, see the martyrs and the injured, see our children that we've left behind. We hope that this truce is extended and that everyone goes back to their homes.
It would be better if the truce lasts and conditions go back to what they were, and people go back to their land and homes. Whoever lost their home, may God compensate them. May those martyred rest in peace, and may the injured recover. This applies to myself and others.
May God bring what is best, and that is not just a truce, but a ceasefire that lasts. May God bring calm between people, enough with the destruction of homes. People's homes collapsed. They were displaced and left in a panic. They lost their houses, their money, and their property.
Members of Iran's volunteer Basij forces have held parades throughout the country in solidarity with Palestinians, particularly residents of Gaza. March in the capital, Tehran, alone brought together over 50,000 Basij volunteers. Rallies in the capital are being held on iconic Enghilab Street, which means revolution. Participants have marched toward Tehran University, where Friday prayers are regularly held every week. Now, ralliers have voiced support for Gaza residents and condemn what they describe as Israel's genocide against people of the besieged enclave. Nationwide parades mark National Basij Week in Iran. Protests have taken place in other parts of the world in support of Palestinians in Gaza. Muslims in the Philippine capital Manila waved the Palestinian flag, calling for a permanent ceasefire. They also urged UN to hold Israel accountable for its crimes. In the Australian city of Sydney, students of all ages gathered outside town hall condemning Tel Aviv. A similar rally was also held outside the Egyptian embassy in Berlin. Protesters there called on Egypt to allow refugees and humanitarian aid to flow freely into Gaza through the Rafah border crossing. In the Cuban capital, Havana, thousands led by President Miguel Diaz-Canel marched in front of the U.S. embassy. They accused Israel of genocide against Palestinians. Similar rallies were also held in other countries, including the Netherlands and Pakistan. And now joining us for some special coverage are two of our correspondents. One, Mariam Sada, joining us live from Beirut, and Mona Candiel joining us from occupied Ramallah. Ladies, welcome, and I guess I'll swing over and start with you. Mona, if you could, in the occupied West Bank, the latest with reactions to the ceasefire. Now we are into the ceasefire. What have you heard?
Well, here in the occupied bank, Palestinians are following the news from the Gaza Strip, especially, and warning not to trust the Israeli military, because the Israeli military spokesperson said earlier that Palestinians in northern the Gaza Strip, or excuse me, in southern the Gaza Strip, are not allowed to return to their homes or the areas in the center of the Gaza Strip or to northern the Gaza Strip. And also people there said that leaflets had been Rafah unit warning that the Israelis will open fire at the Palestinians trying to return back to their homes. And this is exactly what happened. Palestinians were returning to their homes or areas. Of course, these homes had been completely destroyed or partially destroyed, but the people were trying to return back to check on their relatives, those who had been wounded, and also to take the bodies of relatives to bury them. Israeli tanks opened fire at Palestinians, and reports coming from there said that at least two Palestinians were killed in this shooting, and seven others or less had been wounded. Also, expecting the release of at least Palestinian prisoners because of this deal that was reached. The Hamas resistance movement will release 13 Israelis. Of course, we are speaking about civilians and not soldiers, including women and children. And in return, the Israeli regime would be releasing 39 Palestinian prisoners, imprisoned children and women. However, the issue that we have to mention, that the Israeli police in Al-Quds had summoned the families of those Palestinian prisoners and informed them that no celebrations are supposed to take place, no gatherings as well. They should not be happy to receive their sons and daughters who would be released. And at the same time, they are forbidden. They are not allowed to speak to the media. The Israeli, of course, military would be gathering the prisoners from Megiddo, Damon, and Awfir at the Awfir jail. And then they will release only the West Bank prisoners at the Betonia military checkpoint. However, those from Al-Quds would be released from inside Al-Quds. But this will happen only after the Israeli regime receives those 13 Israeli captives or prisoners that had been held in the Gaza Strip. And after 2 to 3 hours, the Israeli military will be releasing the Palestinian prisoners.
This prisoner swap that Mona was just alluding to is supposed to take place at 5, I believe, or is it 11, or 1500 GMT, which is in about 6 hours from now, I believe. Am I right, Mona? And Mona, before you answer that, another thing that's really ironic is that you mentioned how invasive the restrictions are that the Israelis impose on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. You're going to have your loved one released, and these are mostly women and children, but you cannot celebrate. Yet, we've seen it on social media, Israelis celebrating in masses out on the streets when women and children are getting bombed in the Gaza Strip.
They are a little bit happy because their sons and daughters would be released, would be freed from this torture, because the Israeli jailers in the last few weeks have been torturing Palestinian prisoners inside jails. Families were not able to know anything about their sons and their daughters behind bars. And those who had been freed after finishing their sentences were speaking about the torture, the interrogation, the mistreatment. People were not having food enough or water behind the bars. But at the same time, on the other hand, Palestinians here are sad because of what's going on in the Gaza Strip, because of the murdering and the slaughter of the people, children, women, elderly there, and the destruction of the Gaza Strip, knowing at the end of the day, of course, that the resistance had forced the Israelis to accept the swap deal and forced the Israelis to accept this ceasefire. But at the end of the day, these are mixed feelings, as I'm saying. They are happy, and at the same time sad because they share the feelings of the brothers and sisters in the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, the aggression of the Israeli authorities is that they want to Palestinians not to express their feelings in any way, whether to thank the resistance, whether to say clearly that the resistance groups were the main reason for having their sons and daughters free today. Another issue we have to mention, that the Israeli regime had also met the families of the Israeli prisoners, captives in the Gaza Strip, and also they were clear with them that they are not allowed to speak to the media because the Israeli regime and the military has to check those Israeli prisoners that would be released first, and then there would be different arrangements to be declared by the Israeli military. And up to the moment, the list, including the names of the Palestinian prisoners who would be released, until the moment, it's not clear. We know that we have the names of all the female prisoners and all the names of the children, the minors less than 18 years old. But at the same time, it's not clear whom the Israelis would be releasing today.
Okay, thank you, Mona. Stay safe. That's Mona Candiel joining us from Occupied Ramallah. We're going to swing over now to Mariam Saleh joining us live from Beirut. Hello, Mariam. Hope you're safe and doing well. Now, Ziad al-Nakhala spoke earlier, Mariam. He thanked the resistance factions out of Syria, Iraq, Yemen, but most importantly, he thanked Hezbollah for its contributions to the basically supporting Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza. Anything you have on Nakhala's comments, if you heard him, and if you could, within the recent tensions along the Lebanese border there?
Yes, well, this is just the many out from Palestinian leaders, whether it is Abu Abaida, also the spokesperson, the military spokesperson for Hamas, who said clearly that he thanked the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, in South Lebanon, who had made, like you said, a contribution to assist the resistance. And the Hezbollah had said from the beginning that this front, it's not the original war. The real war is what is happening in Gaza. And once the aggression over there stops, that will stop our operations, despite the fact that many had doubts or questions whether this confrontation in South Lebanon will end or will there be a pause also as well as a result of the pause that we are going to see, that we are witnessing now in Gaza. And it seems that that is the case. We do not have any Israeli shelling from last night, even despite the fact that Hezbollah's operations continued until later in the day yesterday. And yesterday was one of the most intense days of confrontation. Hezbollah had over 20 operations. In some cases, they had simultaneous attacks against three different posts early in the hours of the morning, and they made sure that they attacked areas where there was even presence and gatherings of soldiers or infantries as a clear retaliation of the Israeli assassination of Hezbollah fighters the day before, and also an assassination of a member of Hamas who was driving his civilian car in South Lebanon. And so the resistance made it clear that until the very last moment, just before the truce, they will continue. And they had said, of course, even through mediation, that they are not intending on continuing a confrontation since, like we said, they are a backup front. And so this is what seems to be clear. We also know that this truce will allow a lot of the people who were displaced from the border towns, and we know that some of them have returned. They need to check up on their property, on their houses. Many of them are also going to see if they can have another chance of basically picking maybe their olives, if there are still any that are still standing. And so this is a chance and opportunity for people to go back to their areas, especially in the border towns, which were witnessing those confrontations and they were not safe. But we cannot say the same about the Israeli side. What we're looking at right now from the images is that it is still basically haunted. There's absolutely no single settler that has returned to those settlements, contrary to what we are seeing on the Lebanese side. You still do have a military zone. We have heard from many of the settlers who were forced to leave the area saying that they will not return from fear of the fact that Hezbollah can renew their strikes, or that perhaps Hezbollah might launch another operation similar to the Al-Aqsa flood operation on the 7th of October. And so this is why there's a clear crisis going to be for the Israelis, despite the fact that this itself would probably be a pause for the Israelis too. They might be able to catch their breath. We don't know what might happen after these 4 days, whether this will extend, whether there will be a longer truce, will it lead to a ceasefire, and therefore everything will be halted. In South Lebanon, we do know that there's a lot of schools and the border towns that are not working. They are giving their students either online courses, or many of them have moved to cities where they do have maybe family members and so on, into Sidon, into Tyre, into Nabatieh, some of them into Beirut and other areas in the country. And so they have not been displaced, but they have moved. But you do have families that are unable to return to their houses completely, since some of them are destroyed, despite the fact that we do not have a mass destruction. But the issue now is, the eye is on the fact that the United States has made it clear through one of its envoys, Amos Hochstein, who was also, mediator when it came to the demarcation of the maritime borders. He took guarantees from the Lebanese officials that once the truce was in place, that Hezbollah will halt its operations depending on whether the Israelis do stop. And so it seems that the Israelis too have kept to that, despite the fact that they are still on high alert in their posts, in their barracks, all along the Galilee region, apprehensive of the fact that any time they return, or the Israelis continue their onslaught against Gaza, or they continue their war against Gaza and the aggressions there, and Hezbollah will once more resume its operations and military operations in South Lebanon.
Thank you, Mariam. Stay safe. Always a pleasure. Mariam Saleh there joining us from Beirut. And that brings us to the end of your news bulletin, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On October 7th, Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the group's biggest military action against the Israeli regime. It was a natural response to years of brutal oppression against the Gaza Strip and the deliberate desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque, among other things. The recent escalation between Hamas and the Israeli regime has now stoked fears that the conflict might spill over into the whole region, dragging major players such as the Islamic Republic into the war. A few days after the onset of the escalation, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian warned Israel that West Asia could spiral out of control if it did not stop strikes in Gaza. This warning was widely interpreted as a declaration of intent for Tehran to enter the conflict, if not directly, via its close allies, such as Lebanon's Hezbollah and Syria. Such interpretations have already raised the specter of a major escalation. But should the region brace itself for a doomsday scenario? Will Israel attack Iran after years of warnings? And what's Iran's position? These and more on this episode of Iran Today. Since the very beginning, Iran has taken a clear-cut position towards the developments in the Gaza Strip. The Islamic Republic has lauded the success of the October 7th operation by Hamas and at the same time has condemned Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip, in which more than 8,000 people have been killed. At the same time, Tehran has repeatedly declared that it opposes the conflict's expansion to other parts of West Asia, while also denying involvement in the October 7th attacks. This all has been clearly reflected in the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Just 3 days after the Operation Al-Aqsa flood, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei not only commended the military action, but also asserted that those who doubted this being the work of the Palestinians do not know the Palestinian nation and are miscalculating. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that while the entire Islamic world stands in solemn obligation to support the Palestinians and will do so with divine consent, this is the work of Palestinians themselves. This is Mr. Mehdi Azizi, the director of Negah Hano Center for Media Studies.
As for Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Tehran has asserted that it was totally a Palestinian move. Basically, it was formulated and orchestrated by Palestinian think tanks and had nothing to do with Tehran. Needless to say, it doesn't mean that Tehran is indifferent to the issue. We asserted even back in 2006 that the Islamic Republic of Iran would support the Islamic resistance movement in Lebanon, Palestine, and wherever it might be. So again, it doesn't mean that Iran has abandoned the Palestinian cause or has stopped supporting the resistance movement. No, not at all. But again, the move is totally Palestinian.
Western and Israeli leaders have also said there was no evidence Iran was involved in the operation. Meanwhile, some, mainly in the West, say it remains unclear how far Iran would be willing to go in case of a wider escalation. To know more, we talked to Dr. Sadullah Zarei of Andisha Sazeh Noor Institute for Strategic Studies. He is also a professor of political science at Allama Tabatabai University. Dr. Zarei says Iran and the Israeli regime have been at loggerheads with each other for more than four decades.
Iran has really been at war with Israel during the past 45 years, as has Israel been at war with Iran. As you know, the Israelis, for instance, have assassinated some of our nuclear scientists, so this is a real war. The two sides are also involved in cyber war against each other. Iran has been steadfast in its support of the Palestinian nation against the atrocities of the Israeli regime. In the case of Operation Al-Aqsa, Tehran has shown its complete support. So, when it comes to the Palestinian cause, the Islamic Republic has never been on the margin. Currently, Iran's foreign minister is perhaps the only foreign minister among the Muslim countries that has traveled across the region to rally support for Palestine and the people in the Gaza Strip.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has opposed the Israeli regime in favor of the Palestinian cause. And now Iran's potential entry into the Gaza war will open a new chapter in the hostilities between the two enemies. But what are the odds that Tehran takes this direction? On October 15th, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, "We have conveyed our message to Israel through its allies that if they do not cease their atrocities in Gaza, Iran cannot simply remain an observer." 2 days later, on October 17th, the leader of the Islamic Revolution issued a sterner warning to Israel, stating, "If the crimes of the Zionist regime continue, Muslims and resistance forces will become impatient, and no one can stop them." But does it mean direct involvement in a full-scale war? to Dr. Zari, all options are on the table.
Do you think a direct military war would happen between Iran and Israel?
This is a real all-out war. But let's be more specific. Will Iran enter the conflict with its own jet fighters and missiles? If we feel that the situation will not be resolved without our direct military involvement, don't doubt that the Islamic Republic will do that. But in case it is not necessary, it's quite natural that we will not get involved in the conflict as we don't seek to fan the flames of the war. We will do our best to stop the war and prevent it from spilling over into the region. At the same time, we will do our best to save the Palestinian people from the Israeli bombardment.
Iran has made it clear time and again that it is only likely to engage in direct conflict if Israel attacks Iranian territory or Iran's strategic interests in other countries. During recent military drills in central Iran, Defense Minister Mohammad Reza Ashtiani warned that any inconsiderate act against Iran will provoke a strong reaction.
We are not after warmongering. This is not our strategy. The Islamic Republic of Iran has never started a war since its establishment. We have never started a tension in the region. Never. So the main principle is to avoid war, tension, and instability in the region. But this policy should not be unilateral. I mean, it's naive to see, for example, the Israeli regime is disrupting peace in the region and do nothing to stop it.
Despite its constant warnings, the Israeli regime appears to be reluctant to take direct military action against Iran. Tel Aviv does not have a death wish. The Israelis are fully aware that open confrontation with Iran could be very costly.
Israel's embarrassing failure on October 7th against a resistance group is a telltale sign that the regime's claimed invincibility is no more than a myth. As a major country in the region with great military prowess and deterrence, Iran is no easy target for any country in the world, let alone a regime that cannot even defend itself against a Palestinian group.
Despite displaying animosity towards Iran, the Israeli regime seems to be unwilling to attack Iran directly. Why do you think that is?
It's not feasible for the Israeli regime. In Lebanon and Palestine, the resistance groups have become more powerful. The Iron Dome and the United States military aid have proved ineffective. As a Western expert put it the other way, the Israeli regime cannot even survive for 3 days without foreign aid and support. The blows Israeli regime has received since 2006 and the situation it is trapped in show that Israel is not prepared for a long, full-scale war.
Moreover, Israel has no common border with the Islamic Republic. The geographical distance between Haifa and the Iranian border city of Mehran is over 1,800 kilometers. And the regime would have great difficulty, if possible at all, to dispatch its forces to the Iranian borders. The regime may conduct airstrikes if it manages to pass over the skies of countries such as Syria and Iraq, which have close ties with Tehran, and if it manages to pass through Iran's defense system. This is Mr. Mehdi Khorsan, an Iranian expert in international relations. He thinks the Israeli regime will rue the day if it takes military action against Tehran.
How probable do you think that Iran and Israel will have a direct confrontation?
Look at the way they are dealing with Hamas, a lowly group with no significant support. The Israeli regime, for example, boasts about its Iron Dome. On the other hand, Hamas is a group with limited military power. It's a group under blockade which does not have the technical know-how when it comes to military things. And yet, you see, the regime cannot handle the situation and instead is killing women and children in blind rage. This can illuminate what the situation would look like for the regime in case it goes to war with Iran. Right now, Israel is engaged with Hamas, but there are other resistance groups. Hezbollah has just warned the regime and has not yet had a serious entry into the war theater. It seems that Hamas, the Islamic Jihad movement, and Hezbollah, if form a coalition, can wipe the regime off the region.
That said, the geographical conditions of Israel make the regime prone to Iran's retaliatory attacks. Despite Israel's claims about its military system, experience has shown that it is highly vulnerable, especially against a country like Iran. The Lebanese journalist and political analyst Mr. Hakam Amhaz agreed that geography plays a crucial role in this regard.
The region's geography is of paramount importance. In terms of geopolitics, geoeconomics, and geomilitary, the region is located in the middle between the East and the West, and almost 20% of the world economy is concentrated in this region. So, can you imagine what would happen to the world if something happens to this region? It means a huge loss, not just for the region, but for the whole world. Right now, countries such as the U.S., Russia, Iran, and China each have counted on this region for their own purposes. What happens in this region could be very critical. The next world war might start from this region.
In case of war with Iran, the Israeli regime has to fight on different fronts, as Iran's allies in the region would not remain mere bystanders. And above all, war with Iran would spill over the region with unintended consequences for the whole world. We asked Dr. Zari about what the West calls Iran's proxy war in the region. He said such war is against the Islamic Republic's core principles.
In your opinion, do you think that Iran would engage in a proxy war against Israel? That is, if Hezbollah decides to attack Israel, would that be Iran's proxy? And to what extent does Hezbollah comply with Iran's interests and commands?
Let me be quite frank. The Islamic Republic of Iran doesn't believe in the so-called proxy war. We don't consider proxy war as a legitimate defendable project. We don't believe that a group should bear the brunt for another group. Take Hezbollah, for example. The group is not subordinate to Iran and is not supposed to follow Iran's orders. As a resistance group, it has ties with Iran. It is Iran's ally but is independent of the Islamic Republic. The reason why Hezbollah exists is to defend Lebanon, not Iran. It is not acting as a proxy for Iran. The same is true about Hamas. Hamas does not act as a proxy for Iran and Palestine. The same is true about resistance groups in Iraq. None of these groups act as a proxy for the Islamic Republic.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Israel knows that crossing red lines and engaging in open confrontation with the Islamic Republic could pose an existential threat to the regime. That is why Tel Aviv has constantly pulled back from the brink of war and opted for low-intensity skirmishes that do not jeopardize its survival. Israel's position on Iran has been inflexible.
It has pursued for the so-called surgical strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities and has been implicated in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as sporadic acts of sabotage. We asked Mr. Khorsand if the Israeli regime would use its nuclear warheads against Iran.
In case of any attack, how probable do you think that this will lead to a nuclear war?
I think the Israeli regime would not use its nuclear warheads because of Iran's deterrence power that the country will use when the occasion arises. Moreover, it would be too naive to assume that the United States will give the regime the green light to use its nuclear warheads against Iran.
At the same time, since Israel cannot go into direct conflict with Iran as a regional heavyweight, the regime has always tried to drag the United States and its European allies into war with the Islamic Republic. And right now, Tel Aviv is desperately seeking to expand the conflict big enough for the entry of other countries. In short, pitting the United States against Tehran has been the biggest dream the regime has been chasing over the past few decades. After all, in 2002, former Prime Minister of Israel Ariel Sharon flew to Washington to urge then-U.S. President George Bush to invade Iran instead of Iraq. The Americans didn't because they knew any attack on Iran would be faced with national resistance.
It is said that the Israeli regime is trying to convince the U.S. to go into a full-scale battle with Iran. To what extent do you agree with this statement?
The Israeli regime has always sought to pit the Islamic Republic against its regional rivals and international enemies in a war of attrition. But I believe that the Americans are using their common sense, at least in this regard, and steer clear of a direct conflict with Iran, and they won't listen to the Israeli regime in this regard.
Going to war with the Islamic Republic of Iran is easier said than done. But in case of any serious attack, Israel's first attack might be the regime's last attack.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, enmity towards the Israeli regime in support of the Palestinian nation has been an important part of Iran's foreign policy. But whether the country will enter the Palestinian-Israeli war or not is a question that history has answered.
How probable do you think that there would be a direct war between Iran and Israel?
Every side of the resistance movement knows what to do and does not wait for Iran to tell them what to do or not to do. Operation Al-Aqsa Flood has been undertaken by the Palestinian group alone. Iran's leader said that the country has nothing to do with the operation. This means that the resistance groups are in control and know what they're doing. We are in a volatile situation, but in my opinion, war between Iran and Israel, or between Iran and the U.S., is improbable.
Iran has always cherished the Palestinian cause and proposed peaceful solutions to end the prolonged conflict between the Arabs and Israel. At the same time, despite Israel's provocative behavior, the Islamic Republic has always exercised restraint for the sake of stable peace in the region. But Israel should know it's playing with fire if it's going to act the villain of the peace. To Mr. Azizi, Tehran enjoys both military deterrence and political prudence in its overarching strategic vision.
Look, Iran's missile capability, I'm not an expert and I don't know the matter in detail, but Iran possesses missiles that can reach Tel Aviv in minutes. Basically, Israel's strategic depth is accessible by the very resistance groups in Palestine. There is no question concerning Iran's military strength. It's undeniable. I need to add that Iran, at the same time that possesses military deterrence, has exercised strategic prudence over the past four decades. In other words, prudence, military power, and deterrence have made up Tehran's defense strategy.
So far, without facing Iran in the war, it seems that the regime has already lost the war on at least two fronts. It has lost its reputation as a regime with a powerful army and intelligence services, and it has almost lost its hope of a durable normalization with Arab states.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Iran Today. Please do tune in same time next week and each week after. Till next time, take care.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you and oh God name that thou art our only king.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the important foundations of the Islamic system, especially the Islamic social system, is the institute of family. Islam has put great emphasis on family and the certain criteria before even a family is organized. Obviously, a family is created by marriage, so obviously steps that happen before marriage, during marriage, after marriage, and so on and so forth. Children, providing for the family, the upbringing of the family, all of these things have been answered, have been considered, have been spoken about by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And also some of these issues appear in the Noble Quran. For example, in the Glorious Quran, there are verses that speak about marriage, for example, who one should marry, who one should not marry, especially in a jurisprudential manner. example, who is it allowed for one to get married to, who is it not allowed for one to get married to, but also there are certain other aspects that one can derive from the glorious Quran regarding marriage, but that is a different discussion. But family, in a general sense, is something that is extremely important. It is the foundation of society. So therefore, if an Islamic society has to form or is desired to be formed, it is necessary that it begins from its roots, from its foundation, from its base, which is the family, which is the family structure. So Islam not only provides guidance for the individual and individuals within the family, but also the family as an independent entity, so to speak, in what it should and what it should not do. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be introducing a book that speaks about this particular issue. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Family, from the Islamic and Psychological Points of View. This book was authored by Muhammad Rida Salarifar, and it was translated by Brother Mehdi Azadi. This book was published by MIU Press, which is based in London. The first publication was in the year 2013. This book contains 6 chapters, beginning with the Islamic outlook on marriage and ends with the 6th chapter, which is the family system in Islam. So as we mentioned previously, that Islam as a religion focuses greatly on the family, but also in terms of the new sciences or the new researches that are done on family, on society, especially as the subject of humanities within academia has increased, one of the aspects that one would also like to look at, okay, is what are the psychological, emotional, societal, and many, many other impacts of family that can be, researched, can be examined, can be seen, can be viewed, can be considered. So this book aims to do that, but always look at it from only 2 angles. That is from the Islamic side and that is from the psychological side. So we will just read the preface to get a better understanding of what the book is, inshallah, in our next segment, where we're reading from the book itself. So the present work is a response to the widespread need for references and textbooks reflecting the Islamic viewpoint. In both the various disciplines of the humanities, in universities, and the specialist faculties of scientific and research centers, it is a committed answer to this need that can be used by these institutions to approach their common goals and in addition to improve both the quality and quantity of educational references and avoid repeated work. To this end, Al-Mustafa International Research Institute, MIRI, or MIRI, in cooperation with the Research Institute of Hausa and University, that is RIHU, R-I-H-U, an organization for researching and composing university textbooks in the humanities, known as SAMT, S-A-M-T, submit their project to the academic and general readers community, as well as researchers. So this is basically the goal and the objective of the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners. Hopefully, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of the book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves?
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled Family, From the Islamic and Psychological Points of View. It was authored by Brother Muhammad Rida Salarifar and translated by Mehdi Azadi. Obviously, the book was originally in Persian and published by the MIU Press in London. Firstly published in the year 2013. So we'll be reading from chapter 1, subsection number 3, which is titled Stages of Development in the Family. Psychologists have defined various developmental stages in social groups, ranging from their formation to their expiration. The family also passes through several stages during the passage of time, and every family can be said to be in one or another of these stages. The family is not a static social unit, but a process of constant change. The entity of individuals into the family or the exit from it causes changes within the family. If we consider change as normal in human life, we should understand that the family is very flexible, in constant fluctuations, or more or less in a state of imbalance. As with all living organisms, the family inclines towards its continued existence, and changes are sometimes made for its survival and to maintain a balance. In the development of the family, four stages are generally considered: the two-person unit of husband and wife, the family with small children, the family with school children or adolescent children, and the family with grown-up children. But there are sometimes up to 9 stages as follows. 1. The selection of a spouse and the engagement. Couples without children. Families with children under 30 months. Families with preschool children. 2, 2.5 to 6-year-olds. Families with school children, 6 to 13-year-olds. Families with adolescent children, 13 to 20-year-olds. Families with young children, which have separated from them. Middle-aged parents, family members in old age. Duval believes there are 8 developmental stages in the family, but the stage of selecting a spouse, although before marriage, should be considered important. Although a general model for the development of the family has been presented above, one should recognize that each family has its own benefits, coordinations, rhythm and experiences, or lack thereof, which should be taken into consideration in allowing for a general referential framework of family development. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to benefit from the teachings that Islam has presented regarding the family, and to more importantly implement it in our own families, with our spouses, with our children, with our elders, inshallah, in order for a society that is ready for the reappearance of the Imam to be formed. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil.
this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms, I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you, you of my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, summer deep inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ceasefire takes effect in Gaza following 48 days of unrelenting Israeli air attacks on the Palestinian territory. Head of the Islamic Jihad movement says it will force the Israeli regime into accepting a deal that will guarantee the release of all Palestinian prisoners. And members of the Iranian Basij forces hold nationwide rallies in support of Palestinians in Gaza.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News.
A four-day truce has taken effect in the Gaza Strip, the first major reprieve in over 7 weeks of conflict in the coastal sliver. Temporary ceasefire kicked into effect at